Good morning, Africa. Today is Friday, April 30th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, the latest with Russian dissident Alexei Navalny.
It was Navalny's first appearance since declaring an end to his three-week hunger strike last week.
Also ahead, Turkey goes into COVID-19 lockdown.
The hospital beds are already full, and also the health professionals will burn out. They are already burnt out.
Plus, the French reaction to the conviction of Derek Chauvin. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Russia, where jailed Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny appeared in court after ending his hunger strike. Emma McCarthy of Reuters reports.
Gaunt and frail, Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny again denounced Russia's justice system when he appeared in court on Thursday via video link. His team says he also faces new criminal charges and that the group has decided to disband a network of regional campaign offices. It was Navalny's first appearance since declaring an end to his three-week hunger strike last week and remains defiant. The 44-year-old rejected accusations in the separate case of defaming a World War II veteran.
This whole case is a forgery. Even signatures were forged. You, Your Honor, know it very well and therefore didn't grant the petition to verify the signatures because they were forged. It's probably a new standard of Russian justice.
One of his lawyers said he weighs a mere 72 kilograms, or just 158 pounds, down from 94 kilograms when he flew back to Russia in January. Navalny's team also said on Thursday it was officially disbanding its network of regional campaign offices across Russia. The announcement, posted on YouTube by Leonid Volkov, comes ahead of another court hearing which will consider a request from prosecutors to declare the main pillars of Navalny's political organization as extremist.
To put it short, Navalny's regional campaign offices do not exist anymore. And for me, more than many, it is not just a notion, it is a painful blow to my very heart.
A Russian court has scheduled the main hearing for that case on May 17. Navalny is serving a 2.5-year jail sentence for parole violations on an earlier conviction that he says was politically motivated.
That's Emma McCarthy of Reuters. Brazil has become the second country in the world to top 400,000 COVID-19 deaths after the U.S., and many fear more gruesome days could be ahead when winter hits the southern hemisphere. April is already Brazil's deadliest month of the pandemic, with thousands of people dying at crowded hospitals. Meanwhile, India, which passed 200,000 total COVID-19 deaths earlier this week, continues to struggle with a second wave of the virus. In Mumbai, one grave digger has even been working 24-hour shifts as the outbreak shows no sign of abating. Lucy Fielder of Reuters has the story.
It's the middle of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, but Mumbai gravedigger Sayyid Munir Kamruddin is working too hard to fast this year, often putting in 24-hour shifts as India's coronavirus death toll soars. India reported 3,645 new deaths on Thursday, the country's deadliest day so far.
It's Ramadan and I can't fast. It's summer and my work is hard. We work 24 hours every day. It's so hot. I'm thirsty for water. I need to dig graves, cover them with mud, carry dead bodies. With all this work, how can I fast?
Infections in the country have hit 300,000 positive tests a day for the past week. Hospitals, crematoriums and cemeteries are overwhelmed. Kamruddin has been digging graves in Mumbai for 25 years. At the start of the crisis, he wore PPE, but he gave up 2 or 3 months in. I realised it's nothing, he says. He may not be able to fast this year, but Kamruddin says his faith keeps him going. India's recorded COVID deaths surged past 200,000 this week. But experts believe the true toll in the nation of 1.3 billion people to be much higher.
Thanks to Lucy Fielder of Reuters for that report. Also in COVID-19 news, Turkey on Thursday started a strict new three-week lockdown as coronavirus infections surge. Initially, Turkish leaders claimed success in curbing the pandemic, but the country could be paying the price for a premature easing of restrictions. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
It is the country's most severe lockdown since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, with schools closing, alcohol sales banned, and only essential businesses like food shops allowing to remain open. For this Istanbul shoe shop owner, who wanted to remain anonymous, there is a fear for the future. He says he does not want to call the 18 days of closure unjust, but he really sees it, in his words, as the end. He says Turks are in a state of complete hopelessness. We are finished, he says, adding one can endure this only up to a point. Compounding the economic pain for Turks, the government has not announced any financial compensation. Already, Turkish media report unofficial levels of unemployment exceed 25%, while aid groups report a surge in poverty and warn that large sections of society are struggling to find enough to eat. Intercity travel will only be permitted with special permission. Already there was chaos as people scrambled to return home this week before the restrictions came into force late Thursday. The draconian measures are in response to an enormous surge in COVID infections. Turkey reported 40,000 on Wednesday, the highest in Europe. Şebnem Kurufincancı, chair of the Turkish Medical Association, says Turkey's hospitals are struggling.
The hospital beds are already full. Particularly the intensive care units are full. They have to open new COVID clinics. And also the health professionals will burn out. They are already burnt out. And with this new situation, this would overburden the health system.
The surge in infections come after the government eased restrictions in March.
Uzunca bir süredir takip ettiğimiz rotamızın
Turkish
adı
President Recep Tayyip Erdogan even toured the country holding party rallies in packed indoor stadiums, actions that drew strong condemnation from opposition parties. Erdogan announced the new restrictions Monday, warning Turkey could pay a heavy price if they fail.
Avrupa'nın açılma sürecine girdiği bir dönemde
At a time when Europe is entering a phase of reopening, Erdogan says, Turkey must rapidly reduce the number of cases to fewer than 5,000 and is not, he said, to be left behind. Otherwise, the leader said, Turkey will face consequences in every field, from tourism to trade and education. Tourism is vital for the Turkish economy, providing an essential source of foreign income and providing millions of urgently needed jobs. With hospitals filling up and the peak tourism period fast approaching, analysts see the latest lockdown as a sign that Ankara is aware time is running out. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
Staying in the Mediterranean region, United Nations efforts to restart talks on reunifying the divided island of Cyprus have hit an impasse as Greek and Turkish Cypriot leaders remain apart on key issues. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres convened 3 days of informal meetings seeking a pathway to revive the dormant Cyprus reunification talks. The Greek and Turkish Cypriot leaders, as well as the foreign ministers of Greece, Turkey, and Britain, shared their views. Despite great efforts, Guterres acknowledged not enough common ground was found to allow for the resumption of formal negotiations to resolve the Cyprus problem.
As you can imagine, this was not an easy meeting. And we conducted extensive consultations in a succession of bilateral meetings and plenary meetings in order to try to reach common ground.
Cyprus has been divided since 1974, when Turkey invaded the Mediterranean island following a Greek-backed military coup aimed at uniting Cyprus with Greece. Three UN-mediated negotiations to reunite the island since 2004 have failed. Guterres says the positions of the Turkish and Greek Cypriots remain far apart. He says the Turkish Cypriots oppose reviving past efforts to set up a bizonal, bicommunal federation in Cyprus. Instead, he says, they want Cyprus to have two separate equal states cooperating with each other. The Greek Cypriots, he says, remain steadfast in their demand for a federation. While these contrary positions pose obvious difficulties, Guterres says he is not giving up efforts to reconcile the two sides.
My agenda is strictly to fight for the security and well-being of the Cypriots, of the Greek Cypriots and the Turkish Cypriots, that deserve to live in peace and prosperity together.
The UN chief says he got the parties to agree to meet again in the near future. In the meantime, he says, the UN will consult with the parties in hopes of creating a better environment for the next meeting. That process, he says, is likely to take 2 to 3 months. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA. The Islamic militant group Hamas has rejected Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's decision to cancel the first elections in 15 years, calling it a coup with no popular support. In his announcement early Friday, Abbas cited a dispute with Israel over voting in East Jerusalem, but delaying the elections will likely spare his divided Fatah party another embarrassing defeat. Hamas had been expected to perform well in the May 22nd elections. Earlier, Hamas said voting in East Jerusalem should take place without Israel's permission. In Central Asia, Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan have traded blame for cross-border shelling and clashes that killed at least 4 and injured dozens in a conflict over water supply. It was the latest outburst of tensions between the two ex-Soviet neighbors. Troops from the two countries exchanged gunfire for most of the day around a water supply facility in western Kyrgyzstan on the border with Tajikistan. More than 800 Kyrgyz residents were evacuated from several villages. Later Thursday, officials from the two countries declared a ceasefire and agreed to pull back troops. And Los Angeles police said Thursday that the woman who returned Lady Gaga's stolen French bulldogs was among 5 people arrested in connection with the theft and in connection with the shooting of the music superstar's dog walker. Detectives do not believe that the thieves initially knew the dogs belonged to Lady Gaga, but that the motive for the February robbery was the value of the bulldogs. Lady Gaga's dog walker, Ryan Fisher, is recovering from a gunshot wound he sustained during the attack.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA astronaut Michael Collins died on April 28th at the age of 90 after a battle with cancer. Mr. Collins is remembered for being a part of the famous Apollo 11 moon mission crew. He was the crew member who continued to pilot the command module around the moon as his teammates Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on and explored the lunar surface. Collins also played an important role with NASA's Gemini program as a member of the two-person Gemini 10 mission and was the 4th astronaut to walk in space. He was an Air Force officer and was selected to be an astronaut in 1963. Acting NASA Administrator Steve Jurczyk said in a press release that, quote, NASA mourns the loss of this accomplished pilot and astronaut, a friend of all who seek to push the envelope of human potential, end quote. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Reports of police violence and racial injustice in the U.S. resonates especially strongly in France with its large population of Africans and Arabs. Lisa Bryant reports for VOA from the Paris suburb of Bobigny.
The trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin made headline news in France, but much of the reporting about the trial and its underlying themes of police violence and racism largely zoomed in on the United States.
I think it's viewed as an American problem. With some resonance in France.
Stephen Ekovich is a U.S. politics and foreign policy professor at the American University of Paris.
It also feeds into a certain strain of French anti-Americanism on the left and on the right, so that the French can moralize about the United States and its difficulties and its flaws.
That wasn't the case last year, when George Floyd's death caused many French to look inward. They joined spreading global protests for police accountability. Along with Floyd, many chanted the name of 24-year-old Adama Traoré, whose family says he died under similar circumstances as Floyd's, although that claim is disputed. The black American's death opened a broader spigot here of soul-searching about France's colonial past and continuing injustices today.
La police nationale n'est pas raciste.
French authorities vowed zero tolerance to police racism and brutality and to ban a controversial police chokehold. President Emmanuel Macron called racial profiling unbearable. Police representatives deny systemic racism. They say police are overworked and underappreciated as they tackle violence in tough neighborhoods, and they sometimes become targets of terrorism.
La police nationale n'est pas raciste.
David Olivier Reverdy of the National Police Alliance Union says the country's police aren't racist. To the contrary, he says, they're Republican and diverse from all ethnic origins and religions. There may be some problematic individuals, he adds, but the force itself isn't racist. Critics argue otherwise. A 2017 report by an independent citizens' rights group found young black or Arab-looking men here are five times more likely to be stopped for police identity checks than the rest of the population. Four Paris police officers were suspended last November after TV footage showed them punching a black music producer. In January, six non-governmental groups announced the country's first class action lawsuit on alleged racial profiling by police.
We've been struggling with the state for 10 years.
Slim Ben Ashour is one of the lawyers representing the groups in the case.
We, the French Supreme Court, convicted the state in November 2016 for discrimination. And after that, we could have expected from the state we should actually respect the rule of law. To do some police reform, they have done nothing.
Allegations of police violence and racism are an old story in France. In 2005, the deaths of two youngsters fleeing police sparked rioting in the banlieue, code word for the multicultural working-class suburbs ringing cities here. Activists point to bigger, long-standing inequalities going far beyond policing.
Général de la station Nouvelle en 93. Station, on est situé rue du Chemin Vert.
Some aren't waiting for change from above. In the Paris suburb of Bobigny, youth group Nouvel Elan 93 is mentoring youngsters, helping them with schoolwork and giving them alternatives to hanging in the streets.
On veut essayer de faire en sorte que
one of Nouvel Elan's founders, Abu Bakar Ndiaye, says the group is trying to push youngsters to the maximum of their potential. They're talented, he says, in sports, music, theater, everything.
Ndiaye
says George Floyd's death has resonated in this community and that it could happen to blacks here like him. There's a close relationship, he adds, in the protest for Floyd and for Frenchmen. Adama Traoré. He and other activists say it will take time for the lessons from Floyd's death and France's colorblind creed of liberty, equality, and fraternity to take hold. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Bobigny, France.
Sudan's cabinet this week ratified a UN treaty on the rights of women. But critics note that the Council of Ministers declined to affirm certain rights that would give Sudanese women true legal equality with men. Naba Mohideen reports from Khartoum.
Sudan's cabinet this week ratified the UN Treaty on the Rights of Women, but critics note the Council of Ministers declined to affirm certain rights that would give Sudanese women true legal equality with men. Naba Mohideen reports from Khartoum. Sudan's Ministers' Council has ratified the United Nations 1979 Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW. However, the majority male council declined to endorse the notion that women are equal with men at all political and social levels and have equal rights in marriage, divorce, and parenting. Women's rights groups criticize this reservation and say they will not accept them. This is Ehsan Fagiri, the chief of the initiative No for Women's Repression. Fagiri says the transitional government tends to lower the ambitions of Sudanese people and women particularly. She says ratifying the convention with reservation of acts like those in Article 2 contradicts the goal of the convention. As the article concerns equality, it means that the government doesn't want women to have equality with men in the local legislation. As women, we will not accept that from the transitional government. In late 2018 and early 2019, Sudanese women took prominent roles in public demonstrations against longtime President Omar al-Bashir, who was ousted in April 2019. Last year, some Sudanese women received international awards for their involvement in the democratic change in Sudan. The post-Bashir transitional government endorsed some principles of human rights and women's rights last year, but female activists such as Inas Muzammil are now doubtful the government is willing to enact real reforms. She says ratifying the CEDAW convention with reservation of three fundamental articles caused anger among their women and activist communities. It made them skeptical about the government's willingness to make a real change in Sudanese women's situation, especially given that the women have equally participated with men in the Great December Revolution and expected the transitional government to take this chance and make the change. Some other Muslim-majority countries like Saudi Arabia have reserved some acts when ratifying the 1979 convention. The convention gives joining countries the right to carve out some exceptions to the rights spelled out in the document, although not the fundamental rights like Sudan reserved. Political analysts like Walid Zakaria think the transitional government of Sudan is between a rock and a hard place on women's issues. Walid says the transitional government ratified the convention and made reservation on some articles following some other Islamic countries' approach, as it might be fearing the reaction of the conservative and extremist streams and want to improve its image for the international community at the same time. Meanwhile, the Sudanese government this week also ratified the 2005 Protocol on the Rights of Women in Africa, known as Maputo Protocol. The two conventions are expected to be approved by the Sovereign Council that serves as the current top authority in Sudan. Naba Mohideen for VOA News, Khartoum, Sudan.
Pope Francis has issued an anti-corruption decree. The decree requires Vatican managers, including cardinals, to sign a declaration attesting they are not being investigated or have not been found guilty of terrorism, money laundering, or tax evasion. Sabina Castelfranco reports from Rome.
Since his election in 2013, Pope Francis has been battling corruption inside the Vatican, and his decree, issued Thursday, mandates full economic disclosure and controls for all managers working for the city-state, including cardinals. They will be required to sign a declaration when they are appointed, attesting that they have never been convicted of a crime. They will also be required to declare that they are not under investigation for offenses, including money laundering, corruption, fraud, exploitation of minors, or tax evasion. Vatican managers will also have to declare they are investing funds that are consistent with the Catholic Church's social doctrine. The decree also states that they will not be allowed to use tax havens or accept any work-related gifts that are worth more than $48. They must also not hold real estate obtained with illegal funds. Last May, Pope Francis issued another decree tightening the rules on Vatican departments to secure contracts. But the Pope's latest anti-corruption crackdown is the toughest since he took office 8 years ago to ensure Vatican City employees are not involved in illegal financial activity. For the past 2 years, prosecutors have been investigating allegations of corruption in a Vatican investment into a London property deal. The Vatican has been involved in numerous financial scandals, and the Pope has made clear he would battle corruption from the outset of his pontificate. Pope Francis has spoken about the issue of corruption on many occasions. One of those times was during a trip to Kenya, just 2 years after being elected. Cases of corruption, he said, are found not only in politics, but in all institutions and inside the Vatican as well. Corruption, he added, is something that hits us inside. It's like sugar. It's sweet. We like it. It's easy. But then, the Pope concluded, it ends badly. The Pope's new decree made clear that Vatican employees must adhere to internationally accepted regulations and best practices that require transparency to fight conflicts of interest, patronage practices, and corruption in general. MoneyVal, the Council of Europe's committee that evaluates anti-money laundering measures and the financing of terrorism, is soon expected to publicly release its report, which also includes details on the Holy See's adherence to combat those practices. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
And last of all, Qatar is looking to expand its fish farming sector in the face of climate change, which is devastating the Gulf's marine life. Francesca Lanag of Reuters reports.
This is Qatar's first offshore fish farm. It uses floating cages technology to produce 2,000 tons of fish annually. But its owners are hoping to double that number by expanding the project in order to meet a growing demand for fresh fish in local markets and maintain stocks in offshore Gulf waters in the face of climate change. Warming waters, damage to coral reefs, and overfishing could cause a 30% decline in future fish catch potential in Qatari waters by the end of the century. That's according to Pedro Range, research assistant professor at Qatar University.
The fish stocks in Qatar are, like everywhere else in the world, not in a very healthy state. So there's been many years of very strong exploitation. And that's, of course, reflected in the decline somehow of the fisheries catches in the past decades. And although the fish species in Qatar are physiologically adapted to extreme conditions and extreme temperatures, they're probably also very close to the limits of what they can tolerate.
Al Kumra launched Samkana Fish Farm last November. The company said the project's location, 30 miles offshore from Qatar's Ruwais region, is characterized by cool water currents to achieve the best water quality and ensure shorter growth periods for the fish. But Range said it's not enough to simply rely on local fish preservation efforts.
In terms of climate change, unfortunately, the actions we can take are at the local scale are irrelevant. So we only at the global scale can these actions have a real effect on climate change. What we can do is control local pressures that interact with climate change in terms of controlling the decline in fishery stocks and in habitat availability.
A University of British Columbia study in 2018 found that a third of marine species are at risk of becoming extinct in the Gulf by 2090. Al Kumra is waiting on permits to build new cages, which the company said would enable them to meet 60% of local demand in 5 years' time.
That's Francesca Lanag of Reuters, and that's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Tracy Carter, and our editor, Bill Eagle, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great day.
We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscast covering Africa News. Tune in on the top of each hour 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.